You're listening to TalkTainmentRadio.com on WCRS FM 98.3 and 102.1, Central Ohio's only community radio station, a service of the Neighborhood Network and TalkTainmentRadio.com.
The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and guest and not necessarily those of TalkTainmentRadio.com, the management, the staff, or KNE World Network, LLC.
Welcome to Crossing Cultures, a forum for creating conversations and celebrating our communities. TalkTainmentRadio.com, the world's greatest radio. You're in touch with Crossing Cultures. I'm Julia Lynn Walker, and this is radio the way it should be heard. Today we're going to focus on Black Studies, the International Year, and Decade for People of African Descent. You know, I like to take the first 15 minutes and share with you a related topic to the main discussion. And today I want to talk about African-American studies, Africana studies, Black studies briefly. And I'm actually a product of this process. I know that recently I was in discussion with some young people, and they were asking me to help advise them on a possible college major. And as I was looking at the catalog and looking at all the information, it struck me that there was a lot of information, a lot of majors that really didn't even exist when I came through as an undergraduate. And to me, that reflected the growth of knowledge, the growth of information, and how that information has now been standardized or codified intellectually as majors for people at the college and graduate levels. And so when I came through, I was a hothead. I'm not even going to lie about it. I was a hothead coming out of the 60s. And when I entered college, I didn't want to learn anything that they had. And so there were a couple of others like me, and we argued and fought with the professors, and we decided what we wanted to learn, and we had to have classes in this information. And so we were able to have those classes because it was that kind of society. It was that kind of spirit that was going on, and there was a flexibility. There was an understanding within the college environment that they had to be responsive to what was happening in society. And what was happening in society was the civil rights movement moving into the Black Liberation Movement and just tremendous struggles for liberation among peoples of color worldwide. So we were able to have what we call these independent study classes in Black studies, although it wasn't a major at that time, but it was an interest area. So we just declared it, and we went through the university process and got it established as an interest area, and then had classes. And then we invited colleagues or students, you know, our fellow students on the campus who we thought, you know, would be interested and could understand this information to attend the class. And we identified professors who we thought would be sympathetic to actually teaching the class. So we organized this, you know, as freshmen and sophomores, we organized the area of knowledge that we wanted to study. We organized it within the structure of the campus. And that really evolved into the study of Black studies, or the discipline of Black studies. And so I believe that the first Black studies program in the United States was recognized in 1968. And mid-70s, there then developed what was called the National Council of Black Studies, or an organization of professors and academics and people, authors, to again be able to look at this question of how do you begin to make sure that the information that is conveyed is the correct information. Because, you know, if you go back to Carter G. Whitson, you know, we look at this question of the misinformation of the Negro, and it was not just the misinformation of the Negro, but the misinformation of everybody, because the wrong information was put into the history books. And so, you know, and even then, it was Black studies. And that, and I was really the first person at my college to get a degree in Black studies. And in order to do that, because the campus simply didn't have enough professors, didn't have enough material to be able to provide all the information, and I had to literally resign from my college, apply to be accepted for another college, go there, do a quarter, and then I went to the University of Ghana and did a full year under Ghanaian, Nigerian, Tanzanian professors, you know, and was in classrooms with Zimbabwean, South African, you know, Senegalese, Gambian students. And so that year really solidified for me my ability to understand, you know, the African world from an academic perspective. And so I say that by way of introduction to this clip that I want to share with you now from Professor Abdul Akalimat of the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. And this is someone who has been in the trenches, in the forefront of developing, you know, Black studies to African-American studies as a discipline, and has really been very rigorous in establishing, you know, a standard by which we can look at it. And now he's really taking it to the next level in terms of, you know, where we were in 1968 is different from where we are today. So how do we, in today's context, you know, look at Black studies and begin to think of it from the perspective of a discipline or a philosophy?
Okay. History of Black studies. Three stages. First, Black studies as a social movement coming out of the community. It was the battlefront of the Black liberation movement. On this campus, we have the experience of what's called Project 500. Students rose up. The campus said, okay, we'll have more Black students come on. So they said, well, how many do you want? And people looked around in the room. Somebody yelled out, 500. So it became Project 500. That's how it actually happened. But this is what they did. They brought students into the kind of dorm you're staying at, right? Now, you bring in first-generation college students out of the inner city of Chicago. They're staying in a dorm like that, eating in a cafeteria like that. Everybody's feeling good, like you all. Then, 2 days before school was to start, they told the students, well, now you have to move out because the students are coming. And, oh, by the way, we don't have enough room. So they put cots in the lounges, including in the student union. Some students said, I ain't moving out. They got to struggling and scuffling. They arrested a bunch of people. So the birth pains of the change had to do with the university essentially as a racist institution. And so we had to fight the university to create Black studies. It's my fault. It's my fault.
I'll take a hug any day.
I'm willing to give a hug. Okay. So that's Black studies as a social movement. Black studies, it's academic profession. When we hit the campus, suddenly the terms of our existence changed. In other words, people had to meet the expectations of everybody else on the campus. Tenure track, publish or perish, et cetera, et cetera. Black studies is academic profession. But now we face a new challenge. And that challenge is, based on information technology, we're looking at Black studies as a knowledge network. It's a knowledge network. Now, to begin with, because of the history of Black studies, we have been very sensitive to the need for a theoretical, even value-based orientation. We know that our community is facing the digital divide as a consequence of the social polarity that exists prior to the information revolution. So we're talking about here are three values. First value, cyber democracy. Everybody being connected. So that we, for example, would argue the support of public libraries. As someone said in a lecture on our campus, the library is a socialist institution. It serves a role that does not have to do with the immediate commodification of knowledge in relationship to the patrons of the library. And so even librarians have this social democratic tradition. That is exactly the point about Black Studies, is that we were trying to make it relevant to the community. We were trying to fight for open admissions. And this is fighting for everyone to be connected. Secondly, collective intelligence. If you think about the dream team concept, or the public intellectual concept, or the giving awards concept, we are structuring a what? A hierarchy that has a small group of people at the top and trickle down through the mass media and whatever to the rest of us. That is exactly the opposite of the possibilities for knowledge creation today. Because today, it is possible for us to collectivize all of our ideas, all of the texts we create. See, up to now, things have been based on scarcity, right? Like, for instance, think about any budget you may have something to do with. Scarcity. Think about a book. Front cover, back cover, how many pages in the book? You got to negotiate with a publisher, or if you pick it up, you can't go to bed with a book that weighs, you know, I don't know about you, but I mean, these books on my chest, I'm trying to read at night. You know, I can't relate to that. So what we're talking about here is you have to limit how much you can have in a book. You have to exclude stuff. But now with the digital, we don't have to do that. We can include everything, everybody. And we can make sense of it. I'm not talking talk radio and everybody got a mic. I'm talking about we can actually make sense. We can discern patterns in the texts of everybody. This is a new moment. Now, the hard one is information freedom. Why? Because we've been turned into entrepreneurs. Our university is entrepreneurial. If you take a grant and you get a grant, you are awarded. It's wonderful. If you have a day job in the university, but you got a job hustling money from our community, you are successful. Okay. But let's take something like language. Imagine if language costs. How would it ever develop? Language is the best example we have of collective intelligence and collective wealth because it is collectively generated. Nobody makes language. We all do. And the same has to be true with information. So we're talking about a commons here. Now, of course, this is the new moment. Even if you're trying to make money, the new moment is you must give information to get. So Google. Google doesn't charge you, but Google's making all kind of money. It's a new business model. You give stuff away in order to create an environment in which you can make money. That has not happened in the African-American community. Now, another thing is that digital records are different. Now, if you were selling shoes, I could sell you a pair of shoes. I wouldn't have the shoes. You got the shoes now. I just got some money. I can go buy some other shoes. But if I give you a digital record, I can keep it. I give it to you, but I still got it. I give it to everybody. That's different. And so software starts out $179. A short time later, it's $29.95. And a short time after that, it comes with the machine. That's how fast. Why? Because you all are sharing it and you're not paying for it. They can't stop that. The new economy is bursting out of this containment of the old economy. So we have now the need for, what did she call it last night? Disruptive science. That's what we got to bring to this, right? Why? Because it is a disruptive experience, is what we're talking about here. So, okay, cyber democracy, collective intelligence, and information freedom. And by the way, what this says is not you have to be a purist and just say, give yourself over to the people, although that would be a very hip thing to do. We're talking about relative. So the question is, what do you post on a website that everybody can get to, even if you have a CD you're selling? So how much are you sharing? That's the point. I'm not just trying to be a total ideologue here. I'm trying to say that our community out of which we come, right? requires respect, and that respect means that we have to give back to the community. And what we can give back to the community is not a bag of groceries at Thanksgiving or Christmas, although somebody can eat, that'd be good. It's what we do as digital scholars that's really important for us.
The Voice of Truth host Reina Rosario speaks on issues, personalities, and news of the African diaspora. She also covers politics, community health and wellness, cultural work, and religion. Join a rousing discussion on topics concerning the future of the African diaspora. Heard Mondays on TalkTainmentRadio.com. You may join in this conversation by sending a question or comment to crossingcultures.tt@gmail.com, one word, or like Crossing Cultures Travel and Tours on Facebook. Crossing Cultures Travel and Tours provides a wide range of services to meet your traveling needs, whether for individuals or groups. When you are traveling for business or leisure, we can provide you with an end-to-end service that also respects Africa's contributions. Let me take you back to 2001. In Durban, South Africa, in 2001, thousands of people of African descent representing governments and civil society met to discuss to discuss racism, racial discrimination, and other related forms of discrimination and xenophobia. And it was a world conference hosted by the United Nations. It had come about as a result to really begin to understand what had happened globally with respect to African and African peoples, as well as other people of color, as well as other people who had suffered different forms of discrimination. And it represented for many what was called a seminal or watershed moment in history. And by seminal or watershed, it meant, you know, a dividing line. Because until then, there was a lot of discussion, but with the Durban Conference, people came to the table and were very open and honest about what had happened up to now and what needed to happen going forward. And what needed to happen was put into a document called the Durban Declaration and Program of Action. And so this declaration was very clear, first in stating what we really people regarded as the obvious, that racism existed, discrimination existed, xenophobia existed, and that it, and not only did it exist, but it had been institutionalized by governments in certain policies. It had become institutionalized by governments in certain departments or structures or institutions run by those governments. And in order to get them out, something different had to happen. So it was seminal in saying that if you were serious, you know, it was a watershed moment in that it brought to the table that from you can't keep acting the way you've been acting in the past. The old ways won't get it. So the watershed moment was, if we're really going to get rid of racism, if we're really going to change the world for people of color, then we've got to do something different. And the something different, you know, represented the program of action. And unfortunately, even though many government representatives and certainly the majority of the civil society representatives were very enthusiastic about the program of action, and it was eventually adopted, it was rejected by certain key countries for different ideological reasons or for reasons that they thought were consistent with their political beliefs. And the United States was one. And the United States has really been systematic in undermining the program of action. And I thought it would be important to create a conversation around, you know, how does the U.S. function in the international arena as far as people of color are concerned, and specifically people of African descent? And the Durban Declaration and Program of Action helps us to understand that. Because there were some very specific things that the United States was supposed to do in recognition of their historic involvement in human enslavement, of the fact that certain ideas have become institutionalized in the structure of the society, and so that people began to think that certain things were normal. It was because of the replication of these ideas within the classroom and within other the churches and other forms of communication within the media, you know, certainly. And so many of these things have come out in a lot of the discussion this month because of Black history. And so people have, in the programs of Black History Month, you know, been saying, well, how come I didn't know this or how come I didn't know that? Well, because the process, the way in which information has been shared has been structured in such a way to keep out the experiences of people of African descent. And so, you know, one of the things is, has been at the international level to have certain activities or periods that are similar to the Black History Month. And we discussed how Carter G. Woodson, actually out of his study of history and his involvement in creating a